Hello and welcome to another episode of Football Memories and Moments. You join me live from, in the words of the farmer, with Alan Partridge in my sordid little grief hole in a hotel just off the Edgware Road, which is frankly the worst hotel I've ever stayed in. I won't be naming the names, obviously, but it's worse than certain hotels in South in Wimbledon that I've stayed in. Anyway, I digress. This week we're joined by Kevin Day. Kevin is a stand-up comedian, a comedy writer. You'll know his work without realising you know his work. He's Have I Got News For You, The Mass Report, other current things he's worked on. And he's a well-known Crystal Palace fan, does a lot of work with the club. He also appears on a Palace podcast. And I met Kevin in a pub just off Marble Arch quite recently to chat, obviously, Palace. And a great memory for Palace fans of a certain age, the 1990 FA Cup semi-final and that whole experience of the day for him, and something unique that he thinks he has. And then, even though he introduces that as his moment, I think it's actually right to go with that as first, because obviously he is a Palace fan and I think that's more important to him in his life. And what he went for as a memory stroke moment was something that he had to be proven wrong about. And he's never been more pleased in his life to actually have been proven wrong. But it was when A Touch of Hollywood came to Goodison Park around the turn of the decade, and how he got that experience and of talking to Sylvester Stallone, in his work for Match of the Day 2. And it was really good. There's a lot of talk about class, a lot of talk about how football belongs. And I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. Thanks. Bye now.
My favourite memory probably changes every morning I wake up. There's a new memory, but my favourite moment, while I'm thinking of a memory, my favourite moment will never change. And I'm not ashamed to say, and I think all football fans will realise this, I'm not ashamed to say I've had the conversation with my wife and my son. And the moment my wife said, "Yes, I'll marry you," was a wonderful, wonderful moment. The moment my child was born, my son, who I love more than life, was a wonderful moment. But they realise, and they've come to understand and accept, that there's one moment in my life even better than that. And if you're not a football fan, you're probably best not listening now, because you won't understand this. You'll think, why on earth is a man choosing a football moment? But it's the moment, the 1990 FA Cup semi-final, where Crystal Palace, who'd been beaten 9-0 by Liverpool earlier that season at Villa Park, were about to beat Liverpool 4-3. It's one of the biggest upsets in football history, let alone FA Cup history, even though we're in the same division. And I'm sure, I'm convinced, because of where I was standing in the crowd, we're all moving all over the place, we're still standing. I'm convinced I was the first person to see the referee raise his whistle to his lips. So I started celebrating a split second before everybody else. The 2 seconds after the referee blew the whistle was our first trip to Wembley. It was a remarkable game. That, without a doubt, was the best moment of my life. Because the build-up to it was incredible. No, we couldn't win. It was impossible for us to win, simple as that. And then all the omens were terrible. It's one of the best Liverpool teams ever. It was coming to the end of that great period of domination. But they were one of the best Liverpool teams ever. Player for player, they were better than us all round. They were a better team than us. They had a better history. They'd beaten us, as I say, 9-0 on one of the most humiliating nights of my life. It was awful. Even before the game, they had an RAF dog display demonstration, which was great. You kind of go, you're in there early enough to say, "We'll see the RAF dog display." And they got all the Liverpool fans to cheer for this dog that had a little red jacket on. And the dog in a little red jacket officially broke the record for the course on the pitch. Broke the record, fantastic. They got the Palace fans to cheer for the dog on a blue jacket who fell off the plane. people think, this was a time, a more innocent time, when they were happy for a dog display team to be going on the pitch. Literally minutes before one of the biggest games in football that year. So they set up the course and it's great. It was like, and the Liverpool dog, yeah, even we had to applaud the Liverpool dog. He was a beast. I mean, he just went around his course. It was fantastic. And the Palace dog fell off. And it's one of those moments when you just go, "This is not going to go well, is it?"
Do you believe in omens?
I am the most superstitious. I firmly believe that if we could find the Palace fan whose superstitions work, then we need to find him and wrap him in. Because one of us has got, because we have a big thing at Palace, where the pub we drink in, it's called the Bunny Hole. You come out of the pub, you walk under a little tunnel under a railway line towards the ground, and you have to turn left. Right? You have to turn left out of the Bunny Hole. There are some Palace fans, the reason we got relegated because they turned right out of the bunny hole. And I understand that last season we'd lost 7 games in a row and I turned out of the bunny hole for three home games that we lost. I turned left and we still lost. I understand that. Technically, you'd think I was walking out the wrong side, but I'm not. Over the piece, I'm superstitious. I believe in omens. I believe if I could find the route that I walk that works, particularly the cracks on the pavement, and I'm a middle-aged man, it's not logical. The bizarre thing is I don't believe in omens or superstitions in life, in real life. I'm not a superstitious performer. I don't have to have the same clothes on. I empty my pockets, but that's practical reasons. But life, I don't believe in fate or omens or karma. Football, I totally buy into it. So the fact that this, and he didn't look like a brilliant dog, to be honest. Even when we were watching him, he didn't look. You could sense that they hadn't given the best dog the Palace Jack. They thought they were trying this new. So he literally just stood there 5 minutes before kickoff as they were cleaning dog shit off the pitch and the teams were coming on. You think this is not good. And I've never seen a more one-sided first half in my life. They battered us. They absolutely battered us. And it's strange because they've been trouble on the motorway, so the Palace fans were sort of streaming in over the course of the piece. And there was sort of 3/4 of us were there at kickoff, and then more and more were coming in. And as they were coming in, they're going, how's it going? We're just going, it's a miracle, it's 0-0. And then Liverpool scored. You just got the feeling that if Liverpool needed to score 2, they would in the first half, they would, but they were just playing with us. And it was like a cat with a mouse, basically, in the first half.
If I can remember rightly, I'm trying to remember, because I can only really, off the top of my head, remember, because I remember watching the game live, because yeah. It was the days when it was
both semi-finals, so it was Man United Oldham was the other one.
Was that the
3-3
and then went to a replay?
Yeah, so ours was 4-3, theirs was 3-3.
Yeah, and I remember them being both games, but the only goal I really remember is, I remember 2 goals. One is, you're going to come on and describe in much detail, Pardew. Mm-hmm. And the other is the quite outstanding free kick.
Yeah.
That gets Liverpool, I think, back to 3-2.
Back to 3-2, yeah.
Back to 3-2, and then you come from behind again. Yeah, so, yeah, to start again,
got
so
that,
who,
got them 3-2, yeah.
So who takes the lead?
So Liverpool took the lead in the first half. Ian Rush, I believe. The Liverpool goals are a bit of a blur.
We don't do facts on here either.
Oh, great.
Story.
Great. Well, yeah, could be anyone. Tommy Lawton. No, Liverpool took the lead, and at half time, we were the most we were hoping for. And I'm very pessimistic. Even if I get the omens right, I'm pessimistic. The most we were hoping for was, yeah, just keep it respectable. Let's not go into record books. It's the biggest semi-final defeat. And then, yeah, it's gone down in legend now that Steve Coppell's half-time team talk, he said to them, for the love of God, I'm paraphrasing here, because Steve Coppell, I wouldn't like to reveal Steve Coppell's actual swear words.
Okay.
But he said, and the players all said this, Steve Coppell just went, just, we've got to keep this tight. We can't get humiliated. First 10 minutes, just hold, and then cut to from the kickoff, John Pemberton on the right, I mean, just get a rush of blood to his head, literally from the kickoff, ball ended up at his feet, he ran the full length of Liverpool's half, put a cross in the like of which he's never done before, bounced about a bit, fell at Mark Bright's feet, so within 30 seconds we were at 1-1. So it's, if you see the celebrations at our end, it's a unique celebration, because you're celebrating the fact that we scored a goal in the semi-final, and they're celebrating the fact we're not going to get humiliated because we scored.
Yeah.
And then suddenly we went 2-1 ahead when from Gary O'Reilly, who's a very strange man, scored with a free kick. It's a terrible floated free kick that Gary O'Reilly got his head to. The keeper was off his line. So there we are, 2-1 up. Cut to 4 or 5 minutes to go in proper time. We're 2-1 up. We're thinking, we can get to extra time. That was the limit of our ambition, was to get to extra time. And then Liverpool scored, I can't remember, and then they got a free kick with 2 minutes to go, I think. And then they scored with a free kick, 3-2 up. And then, lo and behold, 15 seconds to go. It was just a typical Palace goal. It was just a scramble into the box. It was a mistake from Hansen, which made all the best. Hansen made a mistake, gave the free kick away. Free kick was floated into the box. Keeper came out, made a mistake, sort of bounced off Andy Gray, went in. Cut to total chaos, shouldn't have happened. And then unless you've been in that situation, any football fan, you don't realise the exhaustion.
Yeah.
If you look at the celebrations for the third goal, even though it's 30 seconds to go before the end of the game, you look at the celebrations for the goal, we barely move because we're so exhausted. But then, so Alan Pardew was quite upset because he thought no one cared. It's not that. Because Alan Pardew then scored the least likely scorer of the winning goal.
not like Pardew to be thinking about himself.
It's amazing, isn't it? Well, do you know what? Alan Pardew, I probably shouldn't say this, but it's a matter of record. The first time I met him, he got slightly humpty because it was the first. He took over as manager, and it was a player of the year thing. Not long at the end, so it's like 3 months. So he'd kept us up, and to be fair, he'd kept us up. So he took us up. He took over in whenever it was, kept us up. He took over in January. We beat Dover in an FA Cup third round game, which he took all the credit for. So he takes the credit for it. He's not modest. Let's put it that way. But so he did keep us up. To be fair, and that was, there's no two ways about that. But. And Steve Parish, the chairman, said to me afterwards, why did you say that? Because I just had to say, because I was hosting the Player of the Year when everyone was, the chant of Super Owl was coming up. And I just said, I don't know why I said it, because I don't particularly like him, to be honest.
Yeah.
And he'd been a bit of a, when I first time I met him, he'd been a bit of a prick. And during the thing, he's very much an alpha male.
Yeah.
So while they were singing at Super Owl, when they stopped singing Super Owl, I felt the need to say to him in front of 3,000 people, you do know that's ironic, don't you? You do know the reason we used to call you Super Owl back in the days is that you were the least super player we had. And he was like, you were. And he's like, what? He wouldn't have it because he's going, oh, I was a brilliant midfield player. So you were. I said, see all the players that are in that team with you, they're all shaking their heads. And as he turned around, they stopped shaking their heads. Like, he was a glazier. I mean, that's one that we always thought, that is that the reason we bought him? Because historically, we needed some more glaziers in the team. It's like, he was the proper fetcher and carrier. That's what he was. Yeah. He was the fetcher and carrier. And it's funny, he's still, I remember talking to one of the Palace players not long after he took over. He said, every away trip on the coach, you'd be driving past his block of flats. And Alan Pardew said, I'll put a glass in that block of flats. Because that's what he was. He was a player. He was a non-league player, ended up at Palace. He was all right for our level, but he wasn't a brilliant player. The Super Owl was ironic because he was just one of the things, no Palace fan could fully understand what he was doing in the team. But then he became an absolute legend. An absolute legend because of all the players you wouldn't expect to score a goal, winning a goal in a semi-final. It was him. And again, it was a corner, old-fashioned corner, near post flick. He bundled it home. I say turn around and still cross it because it's literally, Alan, we really want to celebrate. We were just, we're all cramped up, we're all emotional. It's a minute to go to the end, so we score too soon.
It's almost that burning sensation in your stomach, isn't it? When you've jumped and you've screamed and you've gone around and you've sent your internal organs, especially in those days when you were a bit tighter, you've sent your internal organs everywhere, haven't
that's
you?
That's a really good way of putting it, because after the first two goals, you end up 30 yards away from where you were, and is that. There's that sensation, it's the hope that's well, that sudden sensation when you think we could win this, and even though there's still a minute to go, Liverpool had a chance to win it. You go, we've scored too soon, we should have waited another 50 seconds. Because you don't want to give yourself the hope, you don't want to think you can win it, but then you think this is the greatest result in the history of the world ever. Don't say that because we haven't won it yet. And then you're already thinking, this is going to be a great anecdote. When they invent podcasts, I'm going to tell people about the dog show, and I might exaggerate a bit, but it'll be essentially true. But then, and then to say, just it's one of those things, the crowd, it's like the sea, because it's like, I'm not the tallest, like, I'm normal size, but all my mates happen to be huge.
Yeah.
So, and I just happen to be, so I'm, and it's, in it, this is, again, it's difficult to explain, unless you support a League One, League Two club, listen to this. Most Premier League fans listen to this, probably have no experience of standing at a football game. And the fact is, I'm a huge advocate for the return of safe standing, and I absolutely understand why we have all-seater stadiums, and I agree with that at the time, but I'm a massive advocate, if not just financially, for the sake of allowing disenfranchised people economically to be able to come back to football. I'm a huge fan of... But it was a totally different dynamic when you're standing in the crowd, and so you swear, and it was just at the moment that the very tall people in front of me just parted, and I'm sure the angle I was, I'm convinced. And I've not found anybody... nobody who could disagree with me, but... I saw the ref lift his whistle to it, so I've started celebrating. And it's just like I've never, the split second and the 2-3 seconds afterwards. It's like going home was great. It's just everyone's exhausted, everyone slumped in the car, and even we were out drinking till 2 o'clock that morning. But it's like no point really, because you just couldn't really do anything again.
Couldn't get drunk.
Just couldn't get drunk. And it's like, but that 2 seconds was, because I've been supporting Palace quite a long time already. And nothing like that happened.
How old were you when in the 90 final?
So I was 27 then.
27.
And I'd been going My dad took me to my first game when I was 7. I've been going on my own since I was 12. So it's like 50, and that was every home and away game. So it's like, when I started supporting fans, it was just before we got relegated into Division 3. So my early years were as a lower league team, and then we got, and then it's the whole team of the 80s shenanigans and all that sort. So we were a team without any tradition with us, with no great tradition of success, with no tradition of success. Whatsoever, we won the third division south once. We won the Zenith Data Systems later.
Beating us.
Beating you.
Yeah.
But that was it. So just that 2 seconds made everything that had gone before it worthwhile. When you've been one of 48 Palace fans at Wrexham, when you've been on shitty specials where you've been padlocked into the back carriage of a train, when you've got back from Blackburn at 6 o'clock in the morning from an evening game, every football, the proper fans know that. It's a strange thing, and I realise I'm meant to be talking about my phone. Easily sidetracked.
It's okay.
I feel sorry sometimes. There's a lot of my mates are Arsenal fans, Chelsea fans, and they're just so blasé about success. And I feel for them. Everton, there's one reason I love Everton, but partly Bill Kenwright is the, as far as I'm concerned, the best chairman. And you often find that with the so-called, this is not an insult, but the team that's perceived to be the not the big team in the city, if you understand.
Yeah.
They tend to be a nicer football club than the team that are. Because Everton are a team, they've had success, but their success is spread out. It's not been persistent, it's not been continuous. Everton fans don't take anything for granted the way that Liverpool fans do. Even now, there's no logic why Liverpool, Tottenham fans are the most deluded fans. Why did Tottenham fans, they won the title in 1961, why don't they think they've got any chance of winning it? Yeah, but Everton fans realise their history. They know they're a big club, they know that they have to work for things. But for us, these things come once in a blue moon. So that 2 seconds is just, it's euphoria, it's not the word for it. Euphoria is not the word. And then the 10 minutes afterwards when the players are on the pitch, exhausted, when you know they're not the best players on the pitch. They weren't. They know that themselves. And they know, most of them, and they'll never get anywhere near that again. That the bond that you get between fans, because a lot of that team were from South London, there were black lads that had all sorts of stick as well. So there was a bond between those group of fans and that group of players. And that, increasingly in the Premier League, that becomes rarer and rarer. And I love the Premier League, but that increasingly, we got two players in the Palace first team, Wan-Bissaka and Zahara from Croydon, which I think is probably a better average than most Premier League clubs. And we love those players better than any other player. Not because they're good players, but because we know the schools they went to and we know the places their dads drank in. You know what I mean? It makes a difference. So that Palace team, that's my best moment.
But something Amy Lawrence said to me, though, is that the reason why I asked her, I think after the mic went off, I sat her down and said, Amy, choose between your best children. What was better, 89 or 98, to 2000?
Yeah.
And the point she made about 89 is that seemed the last team to her where they were genuinely seeing they're one of us.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? It's interesting. I did a thing with Perry Suckling recently. He's really interesting bloke. People underestimate Perry because he's got the accent and because he's a very clever bloke. But he talks very eloquently about being part of an Arsenal team and part of a community. And he talks very eloquently about the fact. It's like, they said the team with Thierry Henry in would have slaughtered us probably.
Yeah.
Just through pace and fitness and whatever. But he wasn't saying it was a good thing. He said, but that was the last Arsenal team that went drinking. And it's the last Arsenal team that, if they went drinking in local pubs.
Yeah.
Not in golf clubs, but in local pubs. Yeah. And if Arsenal fans came up and joined them, they would have a drink with the Arsenal fans. And of course. Things have moved on. Of course they have. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that that's more professional than the players we've got now. But there was something about, I'm really pleased that I started supporting football at a time when you still felt part of the club. And I still do feel part of my club because it's a smaller club. But
do you think football's moving back to that? Because I know you're saying about Everton are a nicer club. We do a lot. Everton do a lot of good things. I have to say, Liverpool are catching up. I think the appointment of Tony Barrett as the fans' liaison office, the best thing, and you're seeing more and more. Do you think we're starting? But do you think that's more because they're being forced to because of the Tories? And
I think every club. That's an interesting question. That last one. It's not necessarily the Tories. The Premier League are actually very, very, very good. The Premier League at cultural and community projects. And the Premier League, it's a strange thing because the Premier League consists of the 20 teams that are in the Premier League at the time. So the makeup obviously changes, but it's, you know, they vote. There's no organisation called the Premier League. It is the 20 teams, so they vote on what. But the ethos of the Premier League is a very good one. But Palace are brilliant. The foundation work we do, the community work we do, with all sorts of young people, with knife crime issues, with fitness issues, all sorts. And there's a lot going on. But I think in the past some clubs did what they had to do. They paid lip service to what they were required to do. And other clubs like Palace and Everton went beyond that. But I think now what's happening is that all clubs are realising that going beyond that is the way to do it. All clubs are realising it's what we call the power of the badge. And that, you know, I'm all I can do as a middle-aged white man, if there are problems with gangs in our area, if there are problems with getting teenage girls into sports or in our area, there's no point me turning up trying to help. But what I can do is raise money most of the coaches in our foundation are young black lads from South London. They can go in and help. They can identify where the problems are. But the power of the Palace badge is astonishing. It's the same all over the Everton badge, the Tottenham badge. That gives you access to all sorts of things. So I'm very, very passionate about, because I've got these stupid old-fashioned romantic ideals about football clubs being the last bastions of working-class community. Football clubs, every single football club came out of a working-class community. They all belong to working class communities. You can see that from the badges, from the nicknames, you know, the fact that we've still got Crystal Palace on our badge because we were started by the Glazers. And that's really important. You know, the Everton is a local church youth club and all that. That's really important. We can never lose sight of that, because there are fewer and fewer working class cultural centres left. You know, I mean, football clubs should be at the heart of it. Football clubs should be open every day for the community. There should be something every day happening for people to say, right, I've got a problem here. I'll tell you what, I'll go to Everton and see if they can help me. Yeah. Or I'll go to Sellers Park and see if they can help me. And that's what we should be working towards. And that is changing. Clubs are realising that power now. We're a long way from our original moment, aren't we?
Well, I was going to say, and ultimately, just to wrap that up then, it's that sense of spirit, it's that sense of love, it's sense that you hope that someone in 20 years down the line has that moment where they're the first person to see the referee blow the whistle for Crystal Palace.
Do you know what, my son, it was my fault. I did this when he was far too young. I tried to force him to go to football when he was way too young, like properly baby. That was my fault, and he just wasn't interested at all. But then, so he's 22 now, he's a very successful stand-up comedian. About 5 years ago, just suddenly something switched on in his head. Right, and he knows more about football than I do now, and he loves it. But the first time I took him to Palace, when he had his own season ticket, that was such a proud moment. And it's just, and because I'm old enough now that all my mates, their kids are coming to football, and a couple of them are bringing their kids to football. And that's so, for me, because I have got this, some people call it ludicrous, romanticised notion of football. I have got this romantic idea of football. For me, seeing new generations coming through supporting Palace, it's just, Boxing Day in the pub we're drinking, when everyone's home, I get really emotional about it. And it's the same, you'll feel the same about Everton. You just want, and I think the beauty of being an Everton fan is, Liverpool fans will disagree with me, but a lot of Liverpool fans are tourists. You know what I mean? A lot of Everton fans, and I'm not suggesting that you're more likely to support Everton if you're from Liverpool.
No.
But your tourists are more likely to want to go to Anfield than they are to Goodison Park.
Yeah, I think that's a better way of saying
tourists are more likely. So I think at Goodison Park you get a more fair reflection of the community than you might do at Anfield.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's the same at Chelsea. Tottenham, if you go to Fulham, you'll get more people from West London than you will do if you go to Chelsea, simply because it's more of a Chelsea. People want to go to Chelsea. But, and I'd like to think, if I was in Liverpool, if I was born in Manchester, I'd have ended up supporting. So, and that's why I've always got an affiliation for City fans, Birmingham City fans, Everton fans, because they ended up like I ended up supporting them. Team in London that's not going to win anything, you know. So they ended up supporting the team in their city that doesn't get all the focus and all the attention. Because Everton are always one of the best places to visit football. Just as a fan and as a broadcaster, Everton's a brilliant place to go.
Just last thing though, there's in the style of Everton, you know, time, we have a famous meme called "Time for Everton." What's that? Your striker hasn't scored in 10 games. Time for Everton. You know, you have this beautiful 89 moment, and then the final. You're ultimately, it's kind of an anticlimax a little bit, isn't it? Just to finish off on that.
The final wasn't oddly enough.
You let Lee Martin score the winning goal in it.
The replay was a disaster. The replay, if we'd lost on the day, I'd have been perfectly happy. The the odd thing about the final was that was the first time I've been to Wembley, so I didn't go to England games. So it's the first time I've been to Wembley, and for a lot of us Palace fans, it's the first time I've been to Wembley, and it was actually really underwhelming because it was a shit. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible stadium. Yeah. We ended up quite. We had a very bad view. I mean, the first. It looked like if we'd known then that it would take so long to get back to Wembley, we might have been more passionate. But we were really passionate. We kind of thought this would be us every 3 years, in a strange sort of way. That optimism, but it was. We came away from the first game thinking, we've been part of a really good game, but it's just no one really wanted to replay. And then we talk about omens to bring it right back. We walked on the pitch in a yellow and black kit. And we all basically went, well, we deserve to lose now. So we've never had any tradition of yellow and black at all. But our then chairman, Ron Nose, God rest his soul, decided that he would make money out of the cup winning kit. And it's just, that was really disappointing. And then, like you say, Lee Martin scored. It was a terrible game Lee Martin scored. So that's why the semi-final was far more vivid in my memory than the final was itself. The final was great. But the final, once you're at the final, you go, great, we're at the final. But the realisation 4 weeks earlier when you go, we're going to Wembley, that was stronger, that was much better than anything, much better than anything else. In terms of memories, we could be here for hours while I bore you about Palace memories. I mean, the night we first won promotion. Let's not start. I'll be.
We're aware that you've got to shoot.
Danny Butterfield scoring a hat trick. I think I'm lucky enough, and I'm still. I did 10 seasons on Match of the Day 2. It's essentially that bloke from Match of the Day 2 where I did fans pieces. So I travelled with fans to games, or I met managers and players at games, and basically it's to try and give an insight. So I was lucky enough to see a lot of football, a lot of grounds, and meet a lot of people that I would never have met. And I'd been on the pitch. I still, every now and again, I have to go on the pitch at Palace at half time or do something before. And it's, even at my age, there's nothing more exciting than being a non-footballer on a football pitch. I'm going to a football ground when there's no game on. So the fact that I got to do it, all these different. And two memories stick out, both of whom, and one of which I had to do a piece with Ricky Hatton at Manchester City, which came out through his PR people. It just turned out Ricky said he really liked the show and he'd like to be on it. And it's like, you kind of, for obvious reasons, you're not going to say no to Ricky Hatton. And it was slightly odd because Ricky had a fallout with his wife and wasn't there when we turned up in the morning, but did turn up. But it was just fantastic because Ricky Hatton, it was never the world's greatest boxer, but my God, what heart that man had. And he was just... Anybody who's got any interest in sport would love Ricky Hatton because he was a warrior. He's just like, he knew he wasn't as good as some of the fighters he was taking on, but he still went in there. But he didn't really want to talk about boxing. We went into his room, his memory room, and there's all these signed photographs of Muhammad Ali and all this sort of stuff. And I'm going, oh, Ricky, about all he wanted to talk about was first of all Man City, but even more than that, he wanted to talk about Only Fools and Horses. And I couldn't understand, because I could understand it. I like Only Fools and Horses because I'm from just down the road. It's like,
yeah.
But he's obsessed with Only Fools and Horses. So there was this one moment where he's got the original three-wheeler car, the original Del Boy that he bought. So this moment when I was sitting in the car with Ricky Hatton singing the Only Fools and Horses, I've got a monkey in my pocket. And then he's like, and he was great because he said, oh, it's great. I won't do the ads, I'm not good at ads. He said, oh, God, I've got a cockney in it, could be dealt with. Like, and it's just unfortunately, for some reason, the producer was doing outside shots. So it was just me and Ricky with no camera. And it's like, we ended up in this pub later on with Ricky Hatton singing Blue Moon, which was great. As a Man City fan, I've got a lot of time for Man City fans. But that just one of those moments when you think, I'm actually in the original three-wheeler with Ricky Hatton. And he's not just upset, he's just an expert on it. It's like he could do it for Mastermind, and he was just and then he showed me all these signed photographs of him and Del Boy and him and like real minor characters. I had to ask him who they were. And then I think even better than that was one where, and it was at Everton, and I know it's your club, but was it 2007? I can't remember the exact year.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Around, but my producer, the guy who decided where we were going for the pieces. And I'd had a piece lined up, I was supposed to be going to Chelsea or somewhere, and he phoned up on the Thursday and said, I think we're going to move it to the Sunday. I wanted to do Sylvester Stallone's coming to Everton. I said, I want you to do that. I went, well, it's difficult Sunday because you haven't got over, because we'd have to go straight. You know, you do it on a Saturday, you give the
quick turnaround, really, the film, to the edit,
yeah, yeah, for the edit and all that, so all those sort of purposes. And he went, no, I think this is going to be a really good piece. And I just went, oh, mate, it's Sylvester Stallone. It's been a long time since the Rocky films, isn't it? It's like, is anyone interested? He's going, yeah, cool, tell. He's Rocky. I went, yeah, he was Rocky. He's like, he's a little old bloke now. And he's like, surely? Like, and yeah, so anyway, so we Julie went up there and he had arranged it. He had a 6-foot Sylvester Stallone cutout, which I was having to carry around with me, which I was cross about on camera. There's a piece of me on camera going, he's not as tall as this. I'm standing there with this guy, he's not as tall as this. He's an old bloke, there's like, no one's interested. I've suddenly got this feeling, because of the way Everton fans were, it's never difficult. When I started doing Matchday Day 2, people always wanted to come up and chat.
Yeah.
But I just got this feeling, because I had this thing with me, and they obviously knew he was coming. We were getting mobbed, and it was kind of like, you just think, this is maybe a little bit more interesting than this, I thought. Maybe the older people in the crowd are sort of interested into it. Cut to, 2 minutes before kickoff or whatever, the announcer said, we've got a special guest with us today. As the teams were coming out, and he said, we've got a special guest with us today. The Rocky theme tune started. Mate, I've never seen anything like it. Even the hairs on the back of my head stood. Every single person in the place just erupted. The two teams, I think it was Everton v Reading, I think that's what the season was. The two teams gave him a guard of honour, and he said, and it's like, I've never seen anyone get a reception like that.
It's easy to work out when, because I think he comes out in a Lecoq Sportif coat,
okay.
And I think we went to Lecoq Sportif around about 2009, 2010.
Well, that could be.
Yeah,
well,
because we played in the cup final in an Umbro kit, and that was our last Umbro kit. Yeah.
I'm that's the sort of knowledge I'm impressed with. You said earlier on you didn't do knowledge on this.
Well, no. That might not be right.
You know what's really annoying about that? I'm doing the Palace podcast tonight, and I'm going to be sitting there going, what year did we, when did we go to Umbro? When did we? Anyway, so the place is going absolutely, I've never seen anything like it.
Shot for the upcoming latest Rocky film?
No. They were there because one of the directors at the time, because the story was that one of the directors at the time was trying to get him interested in investing into the club.
The guy who had bought Paul Gregg's shares.
Right.
The guy who tried to get us, initially in the long term, and I might get corrected by my Evertonian friends here, but he was the one that behind King's Dock, but he tried to get us in that reverse mortgage, which in the long run actually would have had us we would have been in the King, you know where the King's Dock, where the Echo is now.
Yeah.
And he ultimately fell out with Ken Wright, that's why everyone's a big fan of Ken Wright.
I am. Because I am, and I'll tell you what, the upshot of this is there's two really good pics. So it was my cameraman who got the shot. It's a now famous shot. There's a still of Sylvester having his first ever taste of Bovril. And clearly nobody had told him, because I love Bovril, by the way, but clearly nobody had told him that Bovril was geologically hot. And that you never, ever just, you have to wait till halfway through the second half before you begin. It's one of the things I love about football is when somebody takes their four-year-old for the first time, it's trying to persuade him to have a gulp of Bovril or someone to squirrel. But there's a shot of Sylvester tasting the bubble for the first, and obviously the heat and the taste. And I was like, it's Rocky, you know, can't even take bubble. But then cut to, we've been allocated 30 seconds at half time to talk to him. So there was like camera crews from all over Europe and Britain, there's like 24 camera crews. And they're all down the stairs from the sort of director's
desk. Yeah, yeah.
They're all down those stairs.
Yeah, I know.
And the idea was that he would walk past and he'd stop at each one and he'd just say hello, watch Match of Day 2 or shake hands or one
credit. Like a little promo type thing.
Yeah. So all of us had, as we were there, this guy came down, an American guy, top of the director's box, he went, who's Kevin, Match of Day 2? So I went, that's me, he went, can you come this way? And Bill Kenwright, which is one of the reasons I'll always like, Bill Kenwright has always treated me really, really well. And everybody at Everton, I think it comes stems down from him, you get treated like really well at Everton. Bill Kenwright had told Sylvester that I worked for Match of Day 2, and Match of Day 2 was, he described it, Sylvester, as a blue collar program.
Okay.
As a program that real genuine fans wanted to
watch. Which it is.
Which it is.
Which it is.
And Sylvester said, right, I want to talk to him then. I don't want to talk to others, I want to talk to him about. So I got this 10-minute interview with Sylvester Stallone.
Wow.
Which, yeah, it was wow, except of course, because I thought this was a complete waste of time, this piece, I hadn't really worked out any questions to ask him. Luckily, Sylvester's a bit like me, and the sight of the microphone, but he just, Sylvester just gave us his brilliant talk about how he grew up, how sport was important to him when he was growing up, how it was terrible that sport was being taken away from people, that people were being priced out of sport. And it's like, so it turned out to be the best bit. And it's like, and I was on the train on the way home, and I spoke to my, I phoned my dad up because he's a massive boxing fan. And then my dad was like, my dad was in tears. And I put the phone down, and I sat on the train. I thought, and I've met a lot of people. I've met my hero. Yeah. I've met George Best. I've met Desert Hawking. You know, but I suddenly sat on the train. I just thought, I just interviewed Rocky. I just interviewed Sylvester. Yeah. And it was just, it was brilliant. It was just a brilliant moment. And then what was even better about the piece?
I can generally see it actually get, now you're having that realisation again, it's choking you up a bit, yeah?
Because again, it's one of those things where football, it wouldn't have happened without football. Yeah. And I know, yeah, my wife says, don't put yourself down because the football wouldn't have happened if you hadn't built a career in comedy and blah, blah, blah. But that wouldn't have happened without football. And what I just love the fact that Sylvester Stallone was talking to me about what I believe in that the sport belongs to us, belongs to the working classes. And it was a real general, and then of course, the beauty of it is, of course, that for the last line in the film, I was able to throw back to Adrian Charles was presenting. So I got the opportunity to genuinely go, Adrian! it was just one of those things where, and I've loved Everton ever since.
Yeah.
And because it's just like, and Bill Kenwright didn't have to do that.
No.
Because he annoyed all the others, admittedly, but he didn't have to do that. But it's just like, it was a special moment. Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I could tell you, there's a lot like that. But the Ricky Hatton one, and because you kind of think, where would I ever meet these people?
Yeah.
Anyway, let alone have Ricky Hatton asking me to sit in his three wheeler.
Well, the only way, because obviously your main career is that there was a time when panel shows and it's going back to that a little bit. Panel shows are getting mixed up again and with sports stars.
I've looked after people. I mean, I've been in the same room as Muhammad Ali at a charity thing. I've looked after Shane Warne. I've looked after Jonah.
Yeah.
I never get blinded. But this one was somehow because it's also because I was wrong and because it's just one of those moments when you think you just watch that stadium and every single person in the stadium. From the youngest to the oldest, clearly, because the film's must have passed revival, but everyone was just so. And when you see the players, and it's normally it's us that are in awe of the players, but when you saw the players were all wanting to just touch, and it is Rocky, I mean, he knows that.
We had a technical issue. I didn't cry this time, just, you know, to regular followers. I've cried in the past. But I was going to. Just
coming
back
down that you didn't. I didn't know. I
was kind of on something else.
I didn't know the idea was to make you cry.
Well, yeah, you have. Don't worry, you have. And so did Amy, and so did Paul Kendrick. So right. That's all good.
Good.
But coming back to it, is that you were talking about you couldn't get over the surprise, that the love for Stallone. But you've got to remember that he is kind of almost, even though he is Hollywood, Rocky is probably the most ultimate working class story you have in sport, isn't it?
I realise that now. I realise that having met him when, because like I say, it was never my sort of film. I like magic in the film. You know what I mean? That's a different podcast.
You want a bit of escapism, basically.
But of course, I knew all the, by osmosis, you can't escape the classic scenes and the voice and the themes. But it was just genuinely moving to see that, to see every single person in the stadium being taken out of themselves by seeing this, by just being in the same space as Rocky. And then, so for me, and he was Rocky, he was perfectly happy, because I asked the first thing that I said to him, what do I call you, Mr. Stallone? And he said, anything but Mr. Stallone. He said, but if you want to call me Rocky, call me Rocky, which is great, because he's very aware, because his own story, I didn't realise it until afterwards, because his own story was sort of similar. He's like, but it was just, I understood, if I'd met him before the game, I'd have been on my feet applauding him as well, because just in that short space of 10 minutes, it was just so genuine. And people say he's an actor, of course he's genuine, but he's not a good actor, so he's not good enough to act that. So it was what he said about, and because it is a thing I'm most passionate about, and it's a thing that does get me worked up, it does get me emotional. I do believe, and people do think I'm old-fashioned and romantic, but I do believe that football is a bastion of working class history. It's one of the last logical places where a working class community can get together, and it breaks my heart that we have to work so hard to share it with the non-traditional football fan community, with the black kids and the Asian kids who are still scared of football for obvious reasons. And it's like, I want them to get involved, because as far as I'm concerned, they're working class. I want them to share the working class experience. And it's, and I'm fully aware that it's because I've been educated out of my class, and you look at my house and say it's middle class. I'm aware that it's part of the longing for my roots. But for me, football's a working class game. It belongs to the working class community. It belongs to working class people. And to have this bloke, Rocky, share those views with me for 10 minutes, it really did move me, and it still moves me now. And it's just like, but it just comes back to that thing where it's also lessening humility as well. That, and that I dismissed this whole Rocky thing. I said to this producer, who was way more middle class than me, I just said to him, you've got it wrong. It's going to be a pointless trip. And it turned out, it was the sort of thing I needed to learn as well. Of course I'm always right.
I went to see Tiff Stevenson's excellent Old Rope last night.
Yeah, just down the road from here.
You know, she mentioned this working class chip on the shoulder, which she then followed up with, which is always nice when you get hungry, because we can't afford to eat.
It's not a chip. I haven't got a chip on my shoulder, but in fact, the opposite. My view is, what I get cross with on the Irish, my mum's dad's from South London, mum's Irish. My mum's family, what I hate is when working class people go, that's not for the likes of us.
Yeah.
That really annoys me. When working class people paint themselves into the small space and go, I'm not interested in art, I'm not interested in Shakespeare, it's not for me. It is. It's entirely for you. For me, and that upsets me. You know, nothing but the best for the working classes. Everything should be available. The working class people need to explore as well, to find out that there are things that they can take part in. So I don't think I've ever... I used to have a chip on my shoulder. I used to play on class issues, certainly in comedy, but it's important for me, and it's an old-fashioned view, but class is important. It still is important. People need to realise that. And my working classness, if you like, manifests itself in football. It's still a place where the crowd at Sellers Park, in particular, it's a South East London club, the majority of the fans haven't travelled far to get there.
But it's ironic that it's taken a Hollywood superstar to kind of reinforce that for you.
I couldn't put it better myself. That's exactly it. The oddness of it was the ordinariness of him that made him seem even more like a Hollywood superstar, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But I think you should probably end the pod on it. Took the irony of a Hollywood superstar to point that out to him, because that's exactly what it took.
There you go. That was a great chat with Kevin. Obviously, it was in a little bit of two halves there, because there was a bit of a recording issue towards the end, and we were quite aware that Kevin had another meeting to go to, which was great to have his time, because I think it was really worth it. Some really good chats about class, about... I loved his point about football being the last bastion of the working class movement, and about its roots, and it's an interesting one. I think a lot of you might agree with that. Some of you might disagree to say that football is no longer working class because of the way that the clubs are run. But I was really interested to see his words about community, and I'll just reiterate, I think the work, particularly in my own, the club that I support, Everton, their community work is really good. But I think Liverpool are getting better all the time, particularly with the appointment of Tony Barrett, who knows what he's doing so good. And I think he was up for, I didn't know, I don't, he's up for an FSF award. I generally don't know if this will go out before or after, so if he did do well in that, then well done, Tony, and to everyone else. But I think it was a big step for Liverpool to make that appointment. The other aspect as well is just great to hear Bill Kenwright and the idea that, you know, Stallone loved the thought of blue-collar workers. Anyway, you've listened to enough. Thanks once again to Kevin for his time. Thanks once again to Andrew Greaves for executive producing. And thanks once again to Kieran Marr for the music. We're moving towards the end of the series now. We'll hopefully be able to keep entertaining you, and see you soon. Bye.